Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who were they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 12. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician and podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul Abbott.
Good. Oh, I've done it again where I've started with about to...
Good hello.
Good hello to everyone. Merry you.
Merry Beatles.
Oh, dear me. It started badly. It can only get worse from here.
You need a term...
I need a catchphrase.
You were on about catchphrases on the internet.
I was. I can't say good Beatles at the start, especially not in the 60s series.
No. Yeah, you need to find a word that you need to find a word,
just one word.
Yeah, a daytime agnostic greeting. Just hello will do.
Yeah, hello everyone.
Hello. I'll do the stuff first. Please keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort or email us at bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And please like, subscribe and review our show if you would be so kind and consider dropping by our Bandcamp links. I've got a new album coming very, very soon. Well, I say very, very soon. It could be weeks. Well, that's quite soon considering I've been writing it for a year. So I will be telling you about it on here and it'd be lovely if when I do, you have a listen or even consider buying one. But I will tell you more about that when it's actually a thing. Paul, what have you got going on?
Not masses of stuff personally. I'm still a few weeks out from my hip replacement revision surgery, but getting there. Everyone will be dying to know that I can now get around pretty much without a stick. So there we go. So I haven't been doing much, but getting back to rehearsing. But anyway, I have got some stuff for other people I'd like to mention.
Yes.
So this episode will be coming out a couple of weeks after the start of a new podcast from our friends Ben and John, who are doing the Alf-splaining podcast. So, you all remember Alf? Do you remember Alf?
I do remember Alf. I mean, I know of Alf, and I guess we must have watched it at some point.
Yeah, I remember watching Alf when it was on TV here. So this is the alien Alf, whose real name is Gordon Shumway, which is great.
Right.
I think I'd totally forgotten that Alf's name is Gordon Shumway, which is just a brilliant way of, I don't know, making it just, it's just a sitcom, but one of the characters happens to be an alien from the planet Melmac.
Alien life form, ALF.
Yes. But it was, you know, it was a big successful sitcom in America and around the world. And our friend Ben Baker and John have joined forces to bring a British sort of point of view to the episodes of Alf. And it's, they're lovely people to spend time with. I mentioned on Twitter, I think, that one of the things I like about podcasts that are extremely specific is the joy of the niche, but also the joy of people sharing their love for that niche in a friendly and entertaining and welcoming way, so that even if you don't know about the thing,
yeah,
you find joy in spending time with them. And that's what the Alf-splaining podcast is. I must confess, I had a preview of a couple of episodes. Don't tell anyone. So, yeah, everyone dig out Alf-splaining podcast on all the various podcast platforms and enjoy that slab of bizarreness.
Oh, great. Well, I shall do just that. I haven't yet, but it's on my to-do list.
Yes. And also, on Noisebox Radio, who we have talked about before, my partner's sister, Gail, who's one of our listeners and friends and pals and family, really, has just started a show on Noisebox Radio called The Rufty Club, which is described as a mix of music, old and new, obscure and not so obscure, trivia and comedy snippets, and badges to award artists in arbitrary categories, according to the chat. So that's on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. with a repeat on Fridays at 11 a.m. And you can find all the shows on Noisebox Radio just by looking for Noisebox Radio. It'll turn up.
Fantastic.
Great independent online broadcasting from lots of different people. But it's nice that Gail is now part of the Noisebox squad. So that's something to listen to as well.
have to check that one out too. Gail, of course, who coordinated and curated and wrote a large part of the Please Please Me ebook that I was
Yes, and that's worth mentioning because we're actually recording this on World Book Day.
Yes.
So go and get the Please Please Me charity ebook,
which is a series of stories inspired by the title of the tracks on the album Please Please Me.
Yeah.
And I did one. And it was
This is what I love about our sort of little corner of Beatles fandom and podcasting and online stuff is that there's loads and loads of people doing independent, interesting things.
Yes.
And it's really good. It's community. It's sharing and enjoying rather than protecting and gatekeeping, which can very often be the case in fandom.
Yes. Well said. So that's some good things there to get listening to. It's good, actually, good timing. I'm at that point where I could do with some stuff to listen to. You know, you get to those points where you're like, right, done with the big thing here. I'm going to get started on something new. What's out there? So I shall listen to... I'm sure it'll bring memories flooding back. Every time I see any images of Alf, it seems very familiar. I think...
Well,
I
every know. Time you see... You have Alf PTSD that you didn't even realise you had.
Yeah, it's a bit like... It's. I wonder if it's a bit earlier than something like dinosaurs. Like I remember.
Oh yeah,
dinosaurs.
It is a little bit earlier.
Yeah, a bit earlier than that. So I was quite young. So, but.
But there was an Alf comic as well, and I remember we certainly had more than one episode issue of that rather.
Yeah. Okay then. So, any more shout outs, or were we all shouted outed?
No, there's the only bit of Beatles news that's worth mentioning. Again, the problem is we record a couple of weeks in advance, so anything that's news isn't really news by the time the episode comes out. But it's worth mentioning that the news came out today that Johnny Gentle died, and he was obviously the person that the Silver Beatles backed on a tour to Scotland in May of 1960, which is a really, really significant moment in their early career. It's the first time someone says to them, right, you guys will do. You can... You can go on the road, you know, a big entrepreneur, not Svengali, that's not like quite the word, but someone from London, Larry Parnes, saying, yeah, right, we need someone. He's a big name. He puts them together, puts them out on the road in Scotland for 8 days.
Yeah.
And it's really important experience for the Beatles. And obviously Johnny Gentle doesn't linger long in the history of rock and roll, but he plays a very significant part. He's another bit of that jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And sad to hear that he passed away in December.
Indeed. So, fast forwarding a couple of years though, Paul, to 1962, June to September 1962. What were them dare Beatles up to right now then?
I don't know where that accent came from, and please don't do it again.
You don't know where that accent was from, do you?
Knows where that accent was from.
It's a mystery accent. It's designed to confound and befuddle.
Anyway, what you've done is made the introduction to a really, really significant and important part of the Beatles' career just a shambles, Gary. June 62 to early September 62 is the period covered by the tracks we'll be looking at in this episode. But it's nuts how much goes on in that time. So just take, obviously, for a little bit of this, I've got to put Ringo aside because he's back with the Hurricanes.
Okay.
And he's doing, at the moment, we're starting out, he's in Butlins again in Skegness.
Right.
And he's on a contract with them through to early September. But he's not necessarily that happy because there's all sorts of stuff going on. He accepts an offer to join King Size Taylor and the Dominoes. So just assume Ringo's off in Skeggy at the Butlins with the Hurricanes for the first part of this.
Right.
4th of June is the official date of the contract made with EMI and the Beatles.
Right, yeah.
So it was signed earlier than that, but in terms of the official record, that's when it was returned to EMI and dated and put in the files or whatever. So the Beatles are signed. They are now recording artists for EMI on paper.
Yeah.
So on the 6th of June, they have their first, and for Pete, his only EMI recording session. So this is it now. I mean, we're on rocket ship Beatles from here on in, more or less.
Ooh,
a bit of a slow start. You know, like, you know, rockets take off, there's a bit of inertia, it's a bit slow to go.
Yeah, it feels like they're hovering in the air, but they're actually, because they're just...
But
they're
it
just
is moving, it is moving.
Critical mass kind of thing.
Yeah. So they have their session on the 6th of June, which is where they record Besame Mucho, Love Me Do, P.S. I Love You and Ask Me Why.
Yes.
That's run by Ron Richards with Norman Smith and Ken Townsend on engineering duty. They come in with their crappy amplifiers again, and Ken Townsend basically has to run around Abbey Road to find bits and pieces to build a bass amp for Paul that they can record.
Yeah.
And they're running through, and so, like I say, it's under the watchful eye of Ron Richards, and eventually he goes and gets George Martin,
mm-hmm.
who's obviously triggered the signing of them. And so he comes and he attends the session because basically the others say, well, Love Me Do's quite interesting, go and get George. And that's where George comes in, starts talking to them, gives them all this, well, you've done this session, lads, and you should, this is how you need to behave in the studio, and this is the sort of thing we'll expect of you as EMI, da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you don't like? To which the whole world says as one, yeah, I don't like your tie. So that's the famous moment
okay.
in that first recording session, which, you know, I can just picture this moment of like the air freezing around everyone.
Yeah.
Of like, has he just taken it too far, Mr. Harrison?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it shatters and everyone laughs. You know, it's a brilliant moment, and it's definitely worthy of all the, of its legend, that line.
Yeah.
So what else goes on? 9th, 12th, 13th, 15th, 16th, 19th, and 20th of June, gigs at the Cavern Club exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
So they do a big block of time at the Cavern. 24th of June, they do their last gig at the Casbah, which is obviously run by the Bests, Mona Best.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to see this as significant, Mona's not going to do stuff at the Casbah because she's pregnant with Rogue Best and her mother's passed away. So, you know, you think about the things that are happening with their dissatisfaction with Pete, and also the Casbah is not going to be the place that they go to.
Mm-hmm.
But at least they upgrade their amps and get a couple more guitars at this point. So there's a bit of more, you know, professionalism coming in. And apparently what we have on the 29th of July, according to Lewison anyway, and some recollections, although it's not totally definite, it seems like Neil Aspinall drives Paul and John to Skegness.
Right.
So they can personally say to Ringo, will you be in the Beatles?
Oh, okay.
But it's not until the 14th of August that Brian calls Ringo at Skeggy and says, hello, would you like to be in the Beatles?
Right.
And then on the 16th of August is when Pete Best gets fired.
Right.
And still, according to him, you know, it was totally out of the blue, and this is always going to be a matter of one person saying one thing, other people saying another thing, and
yeah,
it's not for us to land on a definitive, really. We can't. No one can.
No.
Just get the information as best you can. But yeah, obviously he's called into the office with Neil Aspinall, and Brian says the boys want you out and Ringo in. But will you play the next couple of shows until Ringo gets here? And so I can imagine Pete totally stunned, sort of goes, yeah. But of course he doesn't.
No.
When he sort of comes to, as it were. Johnny Hutchinson sits in, but Neil Aspinall, who's obviously Pete's really good friend, and in fact the father of Rogue Best that Mona Best is pregnant with, he decides to stay on as part of the team. He's like, well, I haven't been fired. And obviously Neil's a really, really important part of the Beatles thing.
Yeah.
18th of August, Ringo plays his first gig as an official Beatle.
Right.
In Hume Hall in Port Sunlight in Cheshire, or it's Merseyside now, it was Cheshire then. 22nd of August, that famous footage of them in the Cavern Club that Granada TV films.
Yeah.
And the madness of the idea that Pete actually comes down and watches them.
Yeah.
I, goodness knows what was going on there. 23rd of August, John and Cynthia get married.
Right.
4th of September, they have their next EMI session, which is where they record How Do You Do It?
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and they do Love Me Do again.
Is Ringo drumming on all this?
Yes.
Yeah. Someone who ends up different on the single version or something?
Well, this is the one where this is Ringo's first session.
Right, okay.
And sort of in a sort of nerves and an attempt to prove himself, he goes nuts.
Right.
He sort of does too much. He's playing drums whilst also playing maracas and all sorts of stuff, and kind of embarrasses himself a bit.
Oh.
Although if you listen to the Beatles version of How Do You Do It, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
No.
But yeah, in that session, Ringo is going a bit crazy, and so he doesn't necessarily change George Martin's idea that they need a better drummer.
Right.
But of course, they insist that they're not going to put out How Do You Do It?
Yes.
But also when the composer, Mitch Murray, hears it, he basically goes, that's not what I wanted. I'm not going to let them put that out on a B-side. Because the Beatles are saying, well, maybe you could put it out as the B-side of our track, Love Me Do.
Yeah.
And he's like saying, well, no, it's my song, I wrote it. I'm not going to let them release it then. So there you go. That consigns How Do You Do It to the Beatles dustbin of history anyway. And then we're going to close just on the 11th of September. They're back in EMI again. They record P.S. I Love You, Please Please Me and Love Me Do. And that's the Andy White session. Right. Where they have the other drummer.
For all of those three?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's where we'll leave it now. The Beatles are now EMI recording artists and they've cut their first couple of sides. So what could happen next?
Who knows?
Who knows?
We're entering into the most obscure part of the Beatles.
Yeah. And they were never heard of again.
Yep. Well, there we go. So just for my knowledge, remind me then. The stand-in drummer played on the single versions of those songs. But Ringo was in the whole day's album recording.
Yeah, so the actual album itself is Please Ringo. Please Me stuff is mainly Ringo.
Yeah.
Except that it's not as simple as that because this Ringo ends up being the one on the single version of Love Me Do.
Yeah.
So if you hear a version with tambourine, that's Ringo on tambourine and Andy White on drums.
Right.
If you hear the version without tambourine, that's Ringo.
Okay.
It's, yeah.
It's confusing, isn't it? It's much better when it just settles down and it was just Ringo. Right. Just get your drummer sorted, lads. That's not what we need to happen now. But brilliant. Well, there you go. Not insignificant at all. And whilst they were signing their contract and making their first recordings and having to let people go and bring people on board, what were they whistling down the street on their way to their next recording session, Paul? The latest tunes they've heard blasting out of the wirelesses from the open windows of the people's houses.
You've romanticised this so much.
Let's find out, shall we? Look for our first number one of the period, which is Elvis Presley, Good Luck Charm.
Don't want a four-leaf clover. Don't want an old horseshoe. Want your kiss, cause I just can't miss with a good luck charm like you. Come on and be my little good luck charm. Hey, you sweet delight. I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm.
Good luck charm, Paul.
Not me. I'm a ladder you shouldn't walk under, if anything. Oh, woe is me. No, I don't know. I said that. I'm fine. Good Luck Charm by Elvis Presley gets number one on the 24th of May. So that's a little bit before the period I was talking about, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it spends 5 weeks at number one. And it's not a film tune, which is nice.
Right.
So it's not from one of his movies. It's produced by Steve Sholes with Bill Porter Engineering, so the classic team. It's composed by Aaron Schroeder and Wally Gold, the ones who arranged It's Now or Never.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different from It's Now or Never.
Very different, yeah.
Yeah. And it's got a flip side, the B-side is called Anything That's Part of You, which itself gets number 31 on the Billboard Hot 100 in America. But that's just a sort of slow, very slow country ballad. It's obviously on RCA, and it's number one in America as well. So it's an interesting one, this, given what we've been hearing from Elvis recently, like Rockahula baby thingy or whatever it's called. This is, as I say, not a movie soundtrack thing. They have a session where they do like four songs, because he's obviously got this contract to release albums with RCA and he has to do so many sides, so many masters for them.
Yeah.
And he goes in, and increasingly as the time goes on, he has less and less time doing that sort of thing compared to making soundtracks.
Yeah.
And it's funny. This feels very much to me like old school Elvis.
Mm.
Perhaps to the point where it's almost a bit like a parody of old school Elvis.
It is, isn't it? It's
a
bit reminiscent of songs like, I don't know, Teddy Bear?
Yes, indeed.
Where he doesn't want to be something, he doesn't want to be something, but he will be that thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the main thing that jumps out at me from listening to
and
this.
And All Shook Up. It's like and Teddy Bear up. And All Shook Up, yeah, put inside and, one of those fly machines that merges men with flies.
And Heartbreak Hotel. That's not what the machine's meant to do. If he'd if Jeff Goldblum had invented a machine that was meant to merge men with flies, it would have harmlessly transported him to the other machine, and that would have been the end of it.
One day, mankind will invent a machine that deliberately merges men with flies.
Yeah.
Anyway, just to give you a bit of a clue, though, about what Elvis's career is like at the moment of this coming out.
Yeah.
So after he comes out of the military service, we've talked about a couple of films. 1960, he makes G.I. Blues and Flaming Star. 1961, we get Wild in the Country and Blue Hawaii. 1962, we get Follow That Dream. Mm. Then there's a session where they record this song and the other bits and bobs. And then also in 1962, we have Kid Galahad. Also in 1962, we have Girls, Girls, Girls. You know, you can see where his time is mainly spent at the moment in terms of his career. And that's going to continue for a little bit anyway. But it's nice. I think it is nice to have something that's not a weird movie song.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a departure from that. Like I say, it's definitely reminiscent of oldie Elvis-y.
Elvis.
Teddy Bear was the one that I went to, was most obvious to me, and things like Heartbreak Hotel. And that made me go and look at when was Teddy Bear? Because I don't know me. Elvis chronology, and it was like, yeah, that 1957, so this is a good 5 years after that. And I think in the scheme of things, because I don't know me Elvis chronology, I'm not a big Elvis nut, I think I'm probably a good barometer for the most people who won't know this one as well as they know some of those other ones. It's one of those, I don't think this one's stood up as much as those
it's ones. Not hung around in the legend, no. You know, as much, which I find very weird given which some of them do. You know, like, this is a number one for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
But if someone says Elvis Presley to you, you don't go, oh, good luck charm.
No. Although I did say to Mum, and she did know what I was on about. But then she does listen more actively to kind of 60s radio shows and things.
And she was there at the time.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think the thing is, I mean, it's got that gentle rock and roll, his dulcet tones. This one's got that added bass voice here and there we've had before in Little Sister, I think, as well, to add a bit of interest and a nice harmony throughout. But it's all very one tone musically, really. The beat is established. The guitar chops along to the walking bass. There's no real change up anywhere or solo section or breakout apart from that bass voice addition that comes in that little later to add some more kind of.
Which is, that's the All Shook Up sort of parody almost. Yeah.
This is where you're starting to kind of build up your sample set of Elvis noises, aren't you? Yeah, it sounds like a bit of a pastiche of Elvis, but a pastiche of Elvis. By Elvis, you know.
Yeah, I wonder if you're like Aaron Schroeder and Wally Gold, and you're like, well, a good thing to do is to get Elvis to record one of your songs. And obviously they did very well off It's Now or Never, you know, huge smash hit. But if you want to get Elvis to record one of your songs, well, probably a good way to do it is go, let's write a song that sounds like Elvis.
That sounds like Elvis, yeah.
Yeah, and he'll go, I'll do that one then.
Yeah. But it's not bad so much as kind of, I find it very standard.
Yeah, that's what I feel about it.
Yeah, and I think history's perhaps chosen to remember the Heartbreak Hotels and Teddy Bears and All Shook Up really over things like Good Luck Charm. So I've only given it 39 for music. I just think it's average for me, average Elvis.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's obviously got the really good lineup of musicians on it, and the Jordanaires are always really interesting in adding the voices that they do, the harmonies and the low sort of bass voices, like I said. But there are better versions of this as well. The Marvelettes, who we know did Please Mr. Postman, do a really good version of this, which I like because it is sort of that scrappy girl group sound, which is much more fun and dynamic than this sort of one tone.
This is one tone, isn't it?
Much as I like the the bass and the piano doubling, which makes for a nice sound. In the bass line,
Let's talk about that in production. I mean, I haven't got much production. It sounds pleasant enough. There's that nice, I've said that there's a nice plucking sound along with the bass and piano. And I think that's the sound of the strings actually being twanged.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And that's nice. And the way that locks in with the beat and the guitar, which is slightly more offbeat, does create a nice overall sound. Yeah, so I think I got that from that nice and locked in piano bass kind of shuffle. And the voices are nicely blended and not too echoey or anything. It's a very nice-sounding Elvis-y track. But there's not really much else to speak about because nothing else happens other than that. Once you've heard in the first few seconds what you're going to hear for the whole song. It was one finger keyboard stuff again, isn't it? Like we're on the Elvis shuffle setting.
Yeah.
It's just going to do that all the way through. So I've given it 48 for production because it's a nice sounding track. It's just not massively interesting.
Yeah, so as usual, Nashville, Tennessee. We're in RCA Studio B, where he is for so much of the things we've heard. And this takes them four takes to do it, and of which the first take is a complete version, the second take's a false start, third take's a false start, and the fourth take is the master, you know. So it's not like they spent ages playing this, rehearsing this, prepping it, planning it, tailoring it. It's they can go in and sort of do this stuff with their eyes closed.
But they shouldn't, because then they might bang into the microphones. That might be why they had the two false starts in the middle.
Yeah.
So lyrics then, I mean, it's so reminiscent of Teddy Bear in that it starts off with that list of things he don't want, i.e. he don't want a four-leaf clover, he don't want an old horseshoe, etc. Just like he don't want to be your tiger, you know what I mean? It's very much a, I don't want this, I don't want that kind of thing. In that vein of that genre, yeah. Of not wanting things, songs. It's hard to ignore how derivative that is when coupled with the similar music. That just stands out to me so much as a lyrical and musical thing to have something that starts with like, I don't want to do, do, I don't want to. It's so strange that you didn't go, well, hang on, it's Teddy Bear, but with good luck charms.
Which may be why people liked it, because they were like, well, we've had It's Now or Never and all that stuff. It's nice to have something that sounds like, and they didn't quite twig perhaps that it was like, oh, it doesn't just sound like it. It's almost straight off the template.
It's the same structure. Yeah, but taken on its own, it's a nice little mechanic into a song. Once that theme's set, you can just list lucky things, you know. And he does, and they're all acceptably lucky things. I was hoping there might be some kind of a, you know, a curveball in there, but they're all pretty straightforward lucky things. Lucky penny, you know, rabbit's foot, silver dollar.
Well, you see, my favourite song about lucky things is, I think the Four Seasons did quite a famous version of it called Lucky Ladybug, which is a great song. Billy and Lily did a version in 1959, and there's a few different covers. And that's a really fun song, which has more or less all the same words in it. You know, it's talking about lucky pennies and rabbit's foot, but it's more chirpy and weird. So people should go and listen to Lucky Ladybug in whatever version they want.
Yeah. Well, that's a good recommendation. It's okay. I just can't shake the Teddy Bear template off of the kind of scoring for it. So I've given it 39 for lyrics.
I don't like the hanging off my arm bit either. It's a bit like,
I just didn't get past the fact that it's just a list of things that are lucky, and then he's saying, but you're lucky. I was like saying, and here's a list of things that aren't cute and cuddly, and here's a cute and cuddly thing. It's like, here's a list of, I want to be your sweetheart, I don't want to be your meat heart. I don't know. There must be some
hearts are made of meat.
Yes. So anyway, 39 for lyrics, 42 overall. So we move on to the next one.
Yes, please.
And it's not a double Elvis A-side, so that's it for Elvis this week.
No, that's it, yeah.
Bye, Elvis, for now. Okay, next we have Mike Sarn with Wendy Richard, Come Outside.
I know the band ain't bad. Little doll, I'm a getting kind of mad. Cause it ain't right to wanna keep on dancing. There won't be any time left for romancing. Come outside.
Lay off!
Come outside.
Shopping.
There's a lovely moon out there.
War one.
Come outside.
Come outside, Paul.
What, you're offering me out for a fight?
Yeah.
All right, well, you go outside your house and I'll get there in a little while.
That's a great way to proffer a fight over Zoom or...
Yeah. Start walking.
Outside, okay. Now.
I'm just cold outside my own house. Anyway, Come Outside. Technically, it's by Mike Sarn with accompaniment directed by Charles Blackwell featuring Wendy Richard.
Yes.
That's what it says on the label. So this becomes number one on the 28th of June 1962. It spends 2 weeks at number one. Produced by Charles Blackwell. Composed by Charles Blackwell. Accompaniment directed by Charles Blackwell. The B-side is a track called Fountain of Love, which I don't understand what it is. It's on Parlophone, but it's an independent production that Parlophone put out. So it's not like they've gone to Norrie Paramore or George Martin or whoever, and produced it and put it out. But Parlophone, I suspect, is the reason it's ended up there is because it's a novelty song. And Parlophone is the label that does comedy records.
Okay.
Until it becomes the Beatles label. But yeah, like I say, it's an independent production they brought, and EMI have said, yeah, all right, we'll put that out on Parlophone. So Mike Sarn is an actor, director, who was in lots of stuff in the 60s, 70s, directed a couple of films, including one which is considered to be one of the worst films ever made. It's regularly on lists of being terrible. He had a few releases and recorded an album's worth of material, essentially, but his next three singles went to 18, 22 and 29. So it wasn't like he was hanging around for mass success as a musician. And I think part of the charm of this track is the fact that it does have the bit where Wendy Richard comes in.
Yeah.
And people will know Wendy Richard, or people in the UK certainly will know Wendy Richard as being a long-term actor in EastEnders, and she was in Are You Being Served and a whole bunch of other stuff, but she had two, you know, those were two really big roles for her. She passed away in 2009. I didn't know she was born in Middlesbrough.
Oh, right.
Even though she basically spent a career playing Cockneys.
She must have spent a life in... Was that an accent then, or did she move to London? Was she born in Middlesbrough and moved?
Do you know
what?
I haven't got a full biography and list of addresses here, but yes, presumably. But she was born in Middlesbrough, which makes her all right in my eyes.
Well, yes, because you were born in Middlesbrough, Paul.
I was, yes.
But you two don't have a Middlesbrough accent because you didn't live there.
Well, no, but no. I've got at least I've got a northern accent.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, what?
So have I.
You're all right, Midlander.
Right.
Right, but yeah, you want Beatles connections? I'll give you a Beatles connection. Wendy Richard, of course, was in a scene in Help that was cut.
Yeah, was that the acting studio?
Yeah, the acting studio with Frankie Howard.
Yes, yeah, okay.
With Frankie playing Sam Ahab or Bahamas in reverse.
Did we establish when we talked about this? Does that footage exist or do we just
know? No, it doesn't. No, no, not at all. It's a real shame. I mean, I understand why it was cut, having read the script of it and also heard it described. It's just another, you know, the baddies try and get the ring again in a different scenario.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounded like a bit of a drag of a scene, a bit too long. And apparently Frankie Howard wasn't very comfortable with the way the boys worked. The boys.
It sounded
like Brian. Like the way the Beatles worked, they weren't comfortable with how he worked because he was a professional and they were stoned.
Right.
Essentially, I think. But yeah, Wendy Richard didn't get told her scene was cut, and she was like, oh, why haven't I been invited to the premiere?
Oh.
But yeah, it's nice that there's some photos exist for that as well. But yeah, she basically gets a role on this record because she was working for Robert Stigwood, the pop impresario. And yeah, she'd been a secretary, and he just sort of decided to say, well, why don't you insert her in the song, do like a call and response thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's what makes the song, without that, it just becomes very, very grotty, the song, because it is a grotty song, I reckon.
Yeah,
apparently she was paid 15 quid with no royalties. I mean, it's kind of lucky she got a name on it at all, really, because I'm surprised they did. But, yeah. So the producer, Charles Blackwell, was the guy who arranged Johnny Remember Me.
Oh, right.
Which was featured in the programme Harper's West One, which later Wendy Richard went to star in for a little bit. And, yeah, it's a novelty record, but it's not a novelty record I like.
No. It's a bit of a change from Elvis, though, isn't it? I mean... Oh, yeah, I was looking at this thinking, Wendy Richard, as when I first saw it written down. I didn't know she was a singer, and then I realised, no, she's not. Nor is Mike Sarn. But anyway, it's not heard in the singing, it's that Mike Sarn fella, whoever he is, and my goodness, he goes toe-to-toe with Richard when it comes to an East End accent, doesn't he? It's all very much...
Cockney through and through.
It has a bit of a feeling of an uncle on the microphone in a working man's club, doesn't it? This the music which I'm talking about now is twee, poppy, kind of movements through major chord progressions that makes it sound kind of bubblegum poppy and childish, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah, except I like bubblegum pop, but this just does not do it for me at all.
I think if you stripped off what was being sung over the top of it, I don't think the backing is doing anything wrong, is what I'm trying to say. I don't think it's really the melody and the, what the guy's singing and how he's singing it. He sings it novelty, if sufficiently, for a comedy song, basically. And then we have that. I wonder if this is officially, Paul, the first female rap solo for a UK number one.
That would be good.
Yeah, technically, you know. She's a first spoken word. I bet there must have been someone before this who's broken off and said some stuff. But it's like the opposite of it in the 90s, where there'd be a female singer for three quarters of the song, and then a male rapper would come on and do a completely random section, and then stick around for the last bit of the song where they'd kind of say yeah a lot. And what? Mm-hmm. But yeah, if we didn't already know that we were in novelty territory by the time that Wendy Richards joined, which is towards the end of the song, isn't it?
Yeah, you get two or three verses or a verse and a couple of choruses and then suddenly Wendy's there answering back.
And we have,
which is good because it needs answering.
Yeah,
back.
I know. It would be good, Paul, if it wasn't the fact that she answers it back and then she comes round to the idea.
Yeah, I know.
We have the distant backing vocals too echoing around. I mean, I don't think anyone's doing anything wrong in the rhythm section. I think the band who's turned up to play this is, they're just going through the motions and whatever. Mm.
They do speed up as it goes along, but not like they're supposed to. It doesn't feel like it's speeding up because it's, it just feels like they've just
one out.
Like, trying to get it over with.
Get it done, yeah. Well, I've only given it 34 for music. It's not for me, this one.
No, nor I.
Production, the main thing that sticks out is the backing vocals and how they've been treated with so much echo. It's almost like you're not hearing the actual main channel, just the echo. But that kind of works as a distant answer and call to him. So the backing vocalists are kind of doing the call and answer stuff until Wendy Richards comes along, and then they kind of stop because she's there now, you know. And that's like, you know, I don't mind that bit. It's fine production-wise, I guess, but the more I have to listen to it to do the notes, the more the spoken word banter grates on me. But, you know, I don't know if the producers can be blamed for that, I suppose. They blend the sung element and the spoken well enough. I just find it all just not my cup of tea.
I mean,
you're saying it kind of gives it its charm, but it's the nail in the coffin.
As such charm it has. The only thing I've got in my notes for production, really, because it bored me senseless, is from Lewison's Big Beatles book. So it's saying this is an independent production for Robert Stigwood, like I mentioned. So he licensed it to EMI, and he's getting 5% on 5% on 90% of singles that are sold, which works out at four times a better rate than the Beatles were getting, which is essentially, I think, like a penny a disc or something in the standard EMI contract. So if you were an independent person licensing stuff, you could get a different sort of deal. Of course, that money then goes to Robert Stigwood, who deducts the costs of making the record, then takes his commission, then passes it on to the artist. So it's all a strange way that the industry works at the time. But
Well, I've given it 40 for production, so... Lyrics then, I mean, this is the meat, isn't it? So where to begin? The story is that there's this guy and this girl who we never actually established are a couple, especially as at one point she introduces the idea to him of kind of copping off with someone called Lil instead. But that's not her. That's like, well, just try Lil. She might come outside with you. Anyway, he wants her to come outside with him so they can be intimate, I guess, in some way or the other.
No, he just wants to show her a lovely moon. Oh, hang on.
And she doesn't really want to. But then he tells her he's going to get mad if she doesn't. Yeah. And she starts to agree, but only for 5 minutes. And as I say, only after she's first suggested he just ask someone else instead.
Yeah.
I mean, when you put it like that, it's all meant to be... I think it's all played as very kind of like tongue-in-cheek... Not innocent, but tongue-in-cheek, kind of like, you know, hey, a bit harmless fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she does agree, so nothing's wrong there. She does agree. She does go, oh, go on then. So I'm not going all snowflakey on this one. I just find it very cringy. that English slap and tickle attitude to sex, which turns it into this bawdy, silly, adolescent thing. You know what I mean?
I just don't like it. I mean, the scenario, there's two of them at a dance. She's enjoying dancing and he's constantly just trying to get off with her, basically. Yeah. I mean, I like the fact it references, she says, I want another twist, which is good because that's a reference to the twist craze that was happening around the time this was made.
Mm.
You know, I don't like the bit where she's like, you can go off people. It's like, yeah, that should have been it. The rest of it should have just been the sound of her walking away.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, she goes, you can go off. She's like, give her over, belt up. And, you know, why didn't you listen to the beat? But then it's like, lay off, shove it. And it's like, all right, not for too long. It's when she goes, all right. I think, oh, come on. I would have much, like you say, it would be a much better record if at the end, I don't know, he'd got arrested. Come outside. Will you please come with me, please, sir? Yeah. Come outside. No, you come with us.
Like, or she says, all right, go outside, wait for me. And you just hear the sound of a door slamming.
Oh,
and you just leave Mike's on there.
Yeah. That would have been better. There's no romance or passion. It's just a quick fumble.
And it's not funny.
No, it's a quick fumble around the back of the bins behind the club type British thing. I mean, I'm British. I'm happy and proud sometimes of some of it. But some of it I just find like it's not my thing. So I've given it 25 for lyrics. It gets 33 overall.
And we never talk about it or him again.
Okay, then. Next we have Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You.
It's useless to say, so I'll just live my life in dreams of yesterday.
I can't stop loving you, Paul.
Gary, it warms my heart to hear that. You know, that's nice after all these years.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? This is a funny song, this one. Right? And I don't mean funny.
It's not funny like come outside funny.
No, well.
Being not nothing, at all.
Yeah. And I'll say just before I give you all the information, the versions you get on streaming now are the full-length album versions. I couldn't find on streaming a copy of the single edit. Mm-hmm. And maybe it exists on Spotify, but I use Apple Music. But I couldn't find a copy of the single edit, which is something like 2 minutes shorter. Necessarily, because otherwise it wouldn't have got the airplay at the time. But there is, you can hear that on YouTube and stuff. So when we're talking about this, our sort of production ears would have been pointed at the nice streaming versions, but we've also listened to the single edit as well on YouTube. And in an odd way, the single edit to me seems too short and the album edit seems too long. But anyway, facts and figures. I Can't Stop Loving You by Ray Charles becomes number one on the 12th of July 1962, has 2 weeks at the top. Produced by Sid Feller, composed by Don Gibson, who had the original release of it in 1958. The B-side's a track called Born to Lose. And this is an absolute worldwide smash hit for Ray Charles, this.
Right.
So if you want to know, this is from Ray Charles' website. Ray Charles received a Grammy for Best Rhythm and Blues Recording for I Can't Stop Loving You. Ray Charles received a Grammy nomination for the Record of the Year for I Can't Stop Loving You. Ray Charles received a Grammy nomination for the Best Solo of Vocal Male Performance for I Can't Stop Loving You. Ray Charles remains the first and only black man to earn a Grammy Award and a number one Billboard pop chart hit with a country and western song, as he did with I Can't Stop Loving You.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that last one's a very specific set of circumstances. But, you know, this was, like I say, a huge smash hit and marks sort of interesting point in Ray Charles's career where he pivots from his soul recordings to this country album that he makes, and obviously he gets something right.
And what contemporary thing has happened recently that we could link to this?
Oh,
it's a quiz quick pop
it's
quiz.
A good, it's a quiz that I have no contextual idea of what...
So he was the first black male artist to get a Grammy or...
Grammy Award and a number one.
A number one.
A country and Western song.
So who recently has had their first country and Western number one?
Is it me? Have I done it?
No, Beyonce, first black female to get a number one.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, literally a few weeks
ago. You're so much more switched on than me.
I listen to Radio 2
yes.
on occasion.
Oh, no, that's really interesting, actually. Yeah. Because there is still...
Which is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. There is still an issue with country and Western being seen as white compared to, say, soul and R&B seen as black.
Yeah.
And even more so in the early 60s than it is now, but it's, you know, madly, it's still the case a little bit. But that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting point.
So you think, you know, 1962, you wouldn't have said, won't be long till the next, to the first black female number one country song. Yeah, no, just give it another 60-odd years, you know.
Yeah.
Quite mad, really.
Yeah, so, I mean... I couldn't possibly do a whole Ray Charles history here.
No.
But I'll just block it out here. So his first is, I mean, he has singles out in like the late 40s, early 50s.
Oh, right. Okay.
But then he goes to Atlantic and he does really, really well on the Billboard R&B charts, but he doesn't do very well on the Hot 100 until 1959. And he has What Did I Say? So big Beatles link there. That was one of their big Hamburg numbers that they'd just play for ages and ages and ages because they could just run it.
Okay.
You know, but that gets him crossover success into the Billboard Hot 100. But he's not really scoring any more big chart hits. And so he leaves Atlantic, or he doesn't re-sign with them once his contract's up. And in 1959, he goes to ABC Paramount. And then he has a hit with Georgia On My Mind.
Mm.
He has a hit with Hit the Road Jack. So those are two probably his most... you know, symbolic of Ray Charles things, I would have say. And then he has this hit, and this is a hit everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's off the Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music album, which people were like, Ray Charles is doing a country album?
Hmm.
And it's a huge smash hit. It makes him a millionaire, you know. It sets him up as a creative entity for the rest of his career, essentially, because it means he can buy his own studio, he can do all what he wants, you know, take the power back to him. It's really interesting. And what's interesting for this is he doesn't like go to his producers and say, look, I've got all these songs I want to do. He says, I want to make a country album. And so Sid Feller, the guy who produces this, the A&R man, says, well, here's 200 songs you could choose from. And... he goes, oh, I'll do these ones. Never heard them before. I mean, he picked well.
Yeah. Very good. He did pick well. I mean, I'd actually never heard... Well, I probably have heard it, but I wouldn't have... Well, no. I haven't consciously heard this and remembered it, if you know what I mean, until this.
Yeah.
I'm very glad to have heard it. And we definitely have something different again this week, thankfully. A very nice singer for a start, and no Cockney sex banter, which is always... I prefer less of in my songs.
Hi, we're Cockney Sex Banter from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Yeah, that works.
Yeah, this is that missing romance and passion I was talking about. It's almost like, as I sometimes have been thinking it happens with these charts, is that the people of Britain in the 1960s would think, why have we been listening to Mike Sarn for 5 weeks at number one? Let's get something really nice instead, you know?
Yeah. It was only two weeks.
Whatever it was. Yeah. But like, we have a country lilt with some lovely vocals, obviously, you know. I mean, I know about Ray Charles. I might not know this song, but I know about Ray Charles and backing choir. Building up...
The Randy Van Horn Singers. Isn't that a great name?
It is great.
I can't make you guess. People will know the Randy Van Horn Singers from lots of things, right?
Okay.
Such as the theme tunes from Top Cat, Flintstones and the Jetsons.
Oh, well, that's a
great pedigree, isn't it?
Yeah, wow. Great. The backing choir and the vocals, building up that feeling, dropping it down to soft ooze. We love some soft ooze, don't we? and then building up to the more bombastic choruses with the "Can't Stop Loving You" refrain, while Ray Charles answers it with his effortless sounding lead. You know, and musically we have a lot of strings doing a lot. Well, not actually a lot of strings. We just have some very prominent strings doing a lot of adornments, and of course his piano, just dripping,
very subtle, isn't it?
Dripping under his fingers. Yeah, it's just when it needs to be, it's just there, isn't it? It's not clunky, clunky all the way through. It's just a bit. You just hear his nice progressions and his little slide downs of his notes, kind of as he goes around the chords. And I'm presuming that's played by Rick Charles.
Yes.
And it's just enough to let you know it's there and keeping it on the side of country more than R&B. I think if he'd taken it too far, he would have been breaking out of this kind of new mold he's trying to kind of work in, you know. But it definitely gives it something. It's lovely, actually. I love the feel and the surging builds and the dynamics of all the performers in this. It's a lovely record. I've given it 60 for music.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite as keen on it, actually, sitting with it for a little bit. Like I say, I think this album version is too long. And I think the single version perhaps is too short. So I feel like if there was a version there, they could have done a 3-minute edit or 3:10 edit or something like that. It would have felt more balanced to me.
I didn't mind it.
It was worth bearing in mind. It wasn't initially going to be a single.
Right.
And when they were putting the album together, when they're programming the album, i.e. choosing what goes where on it, you know, it's tucked away like on the B-side of the album because they weren't like, oh, this is going to blow people away.
Yeah.
But it gets played very early on and the demand is there. So they're like, we better do an edit of it that we can send out to radio stations.
Ah, okay. I don't mind the length, but yeah, hey. Production, it's nicely produced too. I mean, you said about that. Unfortunately, the single version on YouTube is very crackly when everything's all the backing you're in, but I think that's the way it's been reproduced. Sounds like
yes,
it's a mic
yeah,
pointed at a vinyl player kind of setup. It's not a nice clean channel of a mix. They sometimes, even in the album version though, the backing vocals do have that propensity to slightly just be in the vein of that big trebly, sometimes a bit shrill on the ears when it gets very, very loud. But it's just shy of it, I think. It just takes it to that point where you think, oh, it's good. No, but it's okay. And as I say, in the single version, that seems to be very distorted. But the album version, of which I will judge it from, has the backing kind of much more low and mix, and it doesn't suffer for it. And actually, they sound really good when they are lower, like especially when they're doing their humming and whatnot. I love that kind of sound of a whole choir kind of humming nicely.
Yeah.
You know. And I love the shuffle along of this for the backing band and the kind of gentleness of the feel with the short bursts of piano and vocals because it's recorded so well. The piano sounds gorgeous. It's just those backing vocals occasionally being a bit much. But other than that, I think it's a really nice sounding record. So I've given it 62 for production.
Yeah, it's recorded in Hollywood at United Western Recorders. And one of the interesting things I was sort of finding out about whilst looking into this is how much Ray Charles was involved in a production standpoint, a production standpoint, you know. So all these experiences he has in the studio, he's always learning, you know. This is someone who's been blind since very, very early in his life, but was just so involved, you know. He wanted to learn about the mixing desk, the patch bays, how to set up the mics, everything, you know, and he could do it.
Yeah.
Which he brings to bear on a lot of this part of his career, which is, why the money from this really helps him take control, because he's like, well, I can do this myself, so now I can build a studio and have it the way I want it and stuff, which is really interesting.
Excellent, excellent. So, onto the lyrics then. So there's only really a couple of unique lines in here, with lots of repeats and swapping.
It's very country music though, isn't it? It's very lonesome, broken heart.
It sounds like there's more than there is, because he manages to get 4 minutes out of it, you know.
Yeah, call and answer of the same line.
Yeah. Basically, he can't stop loving her. He's made up his mind to live in memories of the lonesome times, which I had to think about a little bit, because it's like, I don't quite get that bit, because I thought he'd be living in the memories of the not lonesome times, unless by living in those memories, it's making him lonesome. Anyway, I don't know about that. But time hasn't healed his broken heart, because since she left, time has stood still. That's a very nice line. I like that kind of flipping the time's a healer, but saying, yeah, but since you've gone, time has stood still. That's a romance line, that is, Paul.
Well, you can thank good old Don Gibson for that.
That's more of a romance line than come outside for some slap and tickle.
Oh,
you know what I mean? That's what I know, but that's what I mean. That's why
I know.
From a culture point of view, it's like our culture is, oh, go on, be slap and tickle, and or you've got the flip side, which is, time hasn't healed my broken heart because since you've left, time has stood still. That's so much nicer.
Country music,
pretty much variations on that theme. It's much, yeah. It's I just think it's people from 1962 wanting to counter the tweeness of their previous number one, but there isn't that many words in there. They're just the same.
My favorite words are "Sing the song, children."
Oh yeah, "Sing the song, children." Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I've given it 48 for lyrics, which gives it 57 overall.
Yeah, just before we move on from that, on the subject of the single side of it, So none of them thought it was going to be a big hit, right?
Mm.
But like I say, it starts getting played on radio, and so because of that, someone else, a guy called Tab Hunter, brilliant name, has covered it, done a sort of, you know, carbon copy of version of it, and he's going to put a single out.
Right.
So they're like, we better get a single version of this out. So they talk, and Ray Charles says, right, edit it there, edit it there, edit it there. And Sid Feller, the producer, is like, oh come on. So he zips down to the studio and he tries to edit it the way Ray's said. And it's like, it doesn't quite work because there's edits where the strings are there one moment and they're not the next. Yeah, yeah. So he has to do his own edit, and no one ever told Ray Charles that. But they basically rush it out.
Yeah.
And send out a few copies to like trusted DJs that they know to play it over that weekend.
Yeah.
And it basically kills the Tab Hunter version dead.
Fair enough.
And gets a worldwide hit out of it. So.
Well, that's what you've got to do, what you've got to do in this business, yeah. Paul. Apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so last song then for this week. It's just a four song of this week. So finally we have Frank Ifield, I Remember You.
I remember you. You're the one who said I love you too. Yes, I do. Didn't you know? I remember too a distant bell and stars that fell like the rain out of the blue.
I remember you, Paul.
I was there the day you were born, Gary. You should do.
Yeah.
Anyway, Frank Ifield, I Remember You. Finally, some yodeling on this chart. Okay. Becomes number one on the 26th of July, 1962, and is there for 7 weeks.
Mm.
Okay, this, I think, is the biggest selling single of 1962, according to the charts we use.
Yes.
Okay, because you have to remember, chart position is not the same as sales, necessarily. There's all sorts of computations you have to do with longevity, how much things are actually sold by. So, yeah. Like, the Shadows were on the charts for longer, but I think this sold more. But it didn't sell as much as Acker Bilk's Stranger on the Shore, which isn't a number one in our charts, so right. Who knows. But it's a huge, huge hit, anyway. And this is why our little block of time for this episode takes us through right into September. Frank Ifield, he's born in the UK, but he grows up in Australia. Then he comes back to the UK for his career in the late 50s. And we will see him 3 more times after this song as well. But I Remember You is produced for Columbia by Norrie Paramore. And it's engineered by Norman Smith, who would go on to do lots of Beatles things. Composed by Victor Scherzinger at Scherzinger? Scherzinger? Not very good pronunciation, was it? Johnny Mercer. In 1941, and it's notably used in a film called The Fleet's Inn, and as sung by Dorothy L'Amour in 1942.
Okay.
And I'll talk more about that in a minute. I've got loads of bits and bobs to do with this, because the thing with Frank Ifield is there's lots of Beatles connections as well.
Okay, right.
So do you want me to do them first?
Do you want to pepper them in, or do you want to just do them?
Well, let me get one out of the way, the big one out of the way. So okay. It's Ifield who's performing in Liverpool. Brian Epstein's there, and he's, oh, I've got a band, I've got to do this. And he says, well, contact Arthur Howes, the tour promoter. We've mentioned him before with Helen Shapiro. And that relationship with Arthur Howes is really important to them solidifying their career in 1963, because he gets them on these package tours and stuff. But it's Frank Ifield who says, get in touch with him. You know, tells Brian to get hold of Arthur Howes. And also what happens off the back of that is he gets the Beatles on a bill with Frank Ifield in December of 1962 in Peterborough, when nobody still really knows who they are. And they go down like a lead balloon.
Right.
But if you start reading any detail into Frank Ifield and the Beatles around this time, bafflingly, you find out that Frank Ifield was going out with Rory Storm's sister, Iris Caldwell.
Right.
Who was at one point George Harrison's first girlfriend.
Okay.
But also at this point, she's seeing Paul McCartney. And so they have this bizarre thing. So she's a performer. She dances and she apparently then meets Frank Ifield while she's in Panto in Stockton. That's the second mention of Stockton. And so there's all, you can read all that sort of relationship hoo-ha of McCartney apparently saying he's going to punch out Frank Ifield. But this song has got that harmonica on it. A sound which is going to be very important to the Beatles, albeit in a more bluesy mode. But he sort of beats the Beatles to the punch as in terms of having a big hit with a harmonica on it. And they like this song. They play it a lot. And if you've got the Star Club tapes, this is one of the songs that's on that.
Yeah.
As well. So, you know, it's Paul sings this, and that's very interesting as well.
Ah. Indeed. So loads of Beatles links.
Oh yeah. Oh, well, I haven't even told you the main one, which I'll tell you at the end.
Okay, then we'll save that for a bit later. So, yeah, firstly, can I say something about this?
Go on.
The harmonica in this reminds me of two things.
Go on.
Of the children's TV series Woof.
Okay.
Opening credits. And of the incidental music in Last of the Summer Wine.
Oh, I can tell you why, certainly for the second part, and it may even be for the first part of that.
Why is that?
Because the person who plays the harmonica on this is called Harry Pitch.
That's a good name.
Harry Pitch. And we have heard him before because he was on Sailor by Petula Clark, which we've covered.
Yeah.
And he was the person who played the theme to The Last of the Summer Wine and all the incidental music.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I didn't do any research. I wonder if he played
you can
Wolf.
Tell. Well, I'm now looking to see.
Well, I'll leave that one with you then whilst I do some. At first, I thought it was Woof, and it's literally just as we were talking, I was thinking, no, it's Last of the Summer Wine as well, it sounds like. It's that sound, that particular type of harmonica.
It's got a particular way of playing the harmonica. Yeah. It's a really nice sound as well.
But it also, this song has a very unusual chord sequence, which I like, simply for variation, I think. You know, I like it when you get songs that don't just follow the same pattern.
Well, it's the 1940s coming through again, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, because it's not starting to, yeah, it's pre kind of everything falling into maybe the three chord pattern kind of thing, but yeah, right up to the last few bars where there's even a variation just for the outro. But you've got that harmonica, you've got your Last of the Summer Wine harmonica, which by the way is a sitcom, was featuring old men in bathtubs in England, a simple bass, but the chords move around almost every bar, don't they? Like There's a lot of movement in there, with some major to minor chord shifts too, which I always like. You know, where you're on a major chord and you go to the minor variation of it.
Yes, I like that as well.
Yeah, and it sounds nice. And then the B section shifts into a kind of a two time to pick up the pace a bit. It kind of moves on a bit, gets a bit faster, and we get Frank Ifield. Is it Ifield or Ifield?
Ifield.
Ifield does some nice falsetto semi yodeling.
Yeah, so he's famous for his sort of yodel in his voice. In fact, he does tracks that are about the yodeling.
He's all about, you know, the yodel.
He's not going full alpine call on this, but he's using it to make the voice stand out.
Yeah, it's got a yodeling quality, but it's by no means a yodeling song. And again, paired with the harmonica, even puts us kind of in
prepared Granville.
Yeah, puts us in country music territory. The UK was obviously going through a bit of a country patch at this point.
Well, there was. I did see stuff in like the trade magazines as well saying country and western will be the big new thing.
Yeah.
Because they would leap on anything, and obviously you'd suddenly then get a spate of records that were...
Well, we're going through that now, again, because of the Beyoncé thing, and because it's there's a big country festival coming up in America, big one, and it seems to be getting pulled up a bit more. In the, I'm hearing more stuff on the radio than I remember hearing before about country music. Anyway, I think it's a neat song. I think it progresses nicely, and it's different enough to generate some interest. I'm not sure I'd want to listen to it over and over again.
No.
It would have caught my attention and I'd gone, it's all right. So it's kind of in that territory. I've given it 44 for music.
Yeah, so I mean, it's fine. You know, the band doesn't do much, but it does allow the harmonica and the voice to come through.
Yeah.
And like I say, with the harmonica and this guy, Harry Pitch, who plays it, apparently he did talk to John Lennon and Paul McCartney in the sort of canteen at EMI when they were like, how do you do that thing on the harmonica? Because they obviously knew this song and they were suddenly in an EMI, and this guy, and Harry Pitch, was essentially EMI's go-to harmonica guy.
Yeah.
And apparently, yeah, he sort of showed John Lennon some tips for harmonica playing in a particular way around this time as well.
So
is nice.
Is that the big link that you were...
That's a big link, that's but it's not the other not one that I want to mention.
Okay, blimey. No. We'll keep...
But yeah, but I will say, right, just before we go on to the production,
yeah.
So it came from that film In the Fleet, or The Fleet's In, sorry, In the Fleet, sung by Dorothy L'Amour, which isn't a yodeling performance by any stretch. And the outline of that film is, a sailor goes backstage for a famous actress's autograph. He winds up kissing her for a publicity photo. The photo circulates and he finds a reputation as a ladies' man amongst his fellow sailors. So they start betting on him on his chances of kissing a very famous but standoffish star called the Countess, played by Dorothy L'Amour. So he attempts to win that bet, but finds he's fallen in love with her. Then she finds out about the bet and is upset, but she finds out she's fallen in love with him.
And everything all works out.
Everything's fine. She sings.
Rom-coms have not changed for 80 years.
Totally that. Yeah.
Okay. Production then. So did I mention the harmonica reminds me of Woof? I did, didn't I? Yes.
Yes, just a bit. And I couldn't find any link to Harry Pitch there, sorry.
It's always nice to be reminded of Woof. I would like to be able to turn into a dog sometimes. They're a funny sound to like, harmonicas. You know, they are. I like a harmonica, you know.
There's different ways of playing a harmonica.
Yes.
There are. There's Bob Dylan.
And there's different harmonicas.
There's Larry Adler. And then there's, you know.
Yeah. There's different harmonicas. There's such a range of different things. And I think they get it right here. He has the capacity to be a little harsh in places, but that's kept down mostly, along with the strings that just prop it up a bit without being overbearing. The little backing band are doing a lot of the work with the shuffle of the nicely recorded bass and kit and guitar, keeping it all together and tight and working nicely behind his very charming voice. I think he's got, you know, he's got a very pleasant, it all combines to make a fairly easily listening kind of experience. So I've given it 50 for production.
Yeah, recorded on the 27th of May 1962 with Norrie Paramore's orchestra. I quite like it's got strings on it, but they're very, very subtle, very well used to sort of leave the harmonica and voice clear.
Hmm. Good stuff. So, lyrics then? Are you only going to hit me with this Beatles thing at the very end of this?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, he remembers her, Paul, he does. She's the one who made his dreams come true and said, I love you too. He also remembers a distant bell and starts...
Stars that fell?
Stars, even. And stars that fell like rain out of the blue, which is a bit alarming.
My favourite bit that's really alarming is the bit where he's like, when my life is through.
Oh, yes.
And the angel, it's like, what? What do you mean? He's like, suddenly it's like, you're dying now? What?
Yeah. Well, yes, he takes it right to its conclusion, doesn't it? You know, at the end of his life, and the angels ask me to recall the thrill of it all, which is, I know it's a necessary evil to make a kind of a rhyming line, but I like the idea that you're going to get to the end of your life and the angels would say to you, can you remember for us the thrill of it all? Because I think most people
think of these pervy angels are like, oh, here's another one. Let's see what we can find out from him.
it's the thrill. I think I'd just be bamboozled being the thrill. You want to know about the thrill? The Wicker Man at Alton Towers? Like the thrill. It's just not the word I'd choose, you know.
But I stood up quickly once and I was like, whoa.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I once went down a big hill, and then when we went back up again, it gave me the willies. Yeah, that kind of thing. But no, not for Frankie. He remembers her as his thrill. I don't know why they didn't use the line, the best of it all, the love of it all. I feel like they could have found a better word than thrill. But then thrill is a strong word, so they probably went, no, you know what? That's fine. Yeah, but again, I think the words are charming enough to go along with the kind of voice. As I say, I don't know why stars fell and like rain. I mean, that sounds like a meteor shower. I suppose if it was like shooting stars, I guess that's quite nice. Anyway, I've given it 43 for lyrics, which means it gets 46 altogether.
Okay, let me round off this one then. Disc Magazine, 21st of July, 1962. I Remember You sets an all-time sales record.
Ooh.
And it's a little report about how basically the factory was having to work 24/7 to keep pressing discs to meet the demand for this.
Yeah.
Which is insane, really. But huge hit, as we've seen. But my favourite thing, the Beatles link that I like about this, is that in America, Ifield's recordings come out on VJ. VJ have some of the Beatles stuff early on. Mm. And so there's an album called Jolly What? England's Greatest Recording Stars, the Beatles and Frank Ifield on stage. And it's just a compilation of tracks that they have the rights to release. And they're not on stage and they don't perform together.
Right.
It's just such a cash in.
Just, yeah.
But the on stage thing is just like, a what?
No trading standards at that point to point out that that's just not true.
But it's, now if you get the original version, Jolly What, which has this bizarre mop-topped, rosy-cheeked man with big beard and whiskers and round glasses on the front of it for some reason, okay. Then apparently that's quite a hard record to find or worth a lot, really.
Oh, I'll keep an eye out for that one then.
But what's brilliant is on the back of it, is there's a little bit of spiel saying about how these are some of the greatest recording stars out of the European scene at the moment. And it says, it is with a good deal of pride and pleasure that this copulation has been presented.
Oh dear. You can't blame that on spell checker, can you? It's on autocorrect.
No autocorrect in 1960, whatever it was. 1964, 63, 64, whenever that came out. But 64, copulation.
Oops.
Oops, indeed.
Sounds like a badly transcribed telegram kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Well, everyone keep your eyes out for that album then. I liked it. You got 46 altogether, and that brings us to the end of the week, Paul.
Right.
And that means we have three that didn't make it into the top 20 this week. They were Mike Sarn with Wendy Richard Come Outside at number 47. Good Luck Charm for Elvis Presley at number 33. And I Remember You for Frank Ifield at 26. So, you know.
Yeah.
Narrowly missing out. But, you know, not making the top 20. So, do you want to hear the top 20? We have one of our songs this week in the top 20. It goes like this. At number 20, The Marcells' Blue Moon. At number 19, Can't Help Falling in Love, Elvis Presley. At number 18, Starry-Eyed, Michael Holiday. At number 17, Helen Shapiro, Walking Back to Happiness. At number 16, Poetry in Motion, Johnny Tillotson. At number 15, Are You Lonesome Tonight, Elvis Presley. At number 14, The Highwaymen, Michael. At number 13, Bee Bumble and the Stingers, Nut Rocker. At number 12, It's Now or Never, Elvis Presley. At number 11, Elvis Presley, Surrender. At number 10, Walk Right Back, The Everly Brothers. At number 9, I Can't Stop Loving You, Ray Charles. At number 8, Elvis Presley, Marie's the Name, His Latest Flame. At number 7, The Shadows, Wonderful Land. At number 6, The Everly Brothers, Kathy's Clown. At number 5, Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. At number 4, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, Shaking All Over. At number 3, Danny Williams, Moon River. At number 2, The Shadows, Apache. And at number 1, Runaway, Del Shannon. I'm starting to kind of like the look of a lot of that top 20, not all of it, you know.
Yeah.
Some of it feels like it's kind of the result of their own legends rather than you can't fault it for being chart material, but not necessarily what I'd like. But some of it's starting to shape up to like, yeah, okay. So that's that.
Yeah, we have to see what happens. And we, like I say, we're on the cusp of Beatleness.
Yes.
A little while off yet, but not far off. So things are going to start changing.
it's going to change massively just by the, you know, in a few months, real time, we'll be talking about all sorts of different songs, won't we?
Yeah.
Okay then. Well, thanks for listening again, and we will see you next week then. Bye-bye.
And a very good Beatle to you.